Distinguished co-hosts, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. There is a sensation going on right now. How do we manage to focus on just one element of our environment? Yes, it is a quite challenging task. Attention.
It refers to how we actually process specific
experiment information
in our environment.
And information.
Attention has been
studied
in a number of different experiments and many theories have been made. One of the strongest influences on the attention is Posner's theory of visual attention. According to Posner's theory,
attention can be viewed
as three specialized sub-problems. Alerting, it refers to maintaining the state of
alertness to the upcoming events. Orienting in the framework of attention is the ability to shift attention towards the target based on the cue. Inhibition is associated with higher order cognitive process, including resolving conflicts, error detection, and response selection. Posner's attention network theory could help us to understand the attentional sub-processes in atypically developing children, such as children with attentional problems or reading difficulties. These difficulties are some of the crucial developmental issues that impact children's learning, and it could lead to an increased risk of academics and psychological consequences. In our research work, we used high-density EEG, that is electroencephalography, with 128 electrodes to record the electrical activity of the brain. Participants were children aged between 12 and 13 years old. Around 450 children participated in this study. Approximately 150 children were invited for EEG measurement. After pre-processing EEG data, we had around 70 plus control children, 15 children with attentional problem, and 23 children with reading difficulties. These children were grouped based on the following criteria. ATEX, Attention and Executive Function Scores. It is a teacher rating scale used to measure different difficulties of attention, inhibition, and executive function in school settings. Reading fluency performance was measured using three different subtests. Attention network test is an experimental paradigm used in our study to measure the performance of the three attentional subprocesses simultaneously. This is a single trial with events. Participants' task is to detect the direction of the center fish is called direction of the center fish called as target by pressing the corresponding key as quickly as possible. Meanwhile, the reaction time was recorded. And all the fish pointing in the same direction is called congruent condition. If the fish pointing in the opposite direction is known as incongruent. In each trial, the stimulus was preceded by either cue or no cue. And one of the approaches to study attentional subprocesses is reaction time performance. Alerting effect can be calculated using difference in reaction times between trials with no cue and trials with double cue. The alerting effect results suggest that the warning cue helps to increase alertness by shortening the reaction time to the target stimulus. Orienting effect can be calculated using difference in reaction time between trials with center cue and trials with spatial cue. Reaction time for spatially cued target stimuli were approximately 55 milliseconds faster than those for centrally cued target stimuli. This shows that children utilize orienting cues to extract the specific spatial location of an incoming target. Inhibition effect is measured by the difference in reaction time between incongruent and congruent target trials. Children responded with a delay of approximately 122 milliseconds for incongruent condition. As overall, this showed that queuing helped to enhance the performance of children, and children had difficulties in responding to incongruence trial as evidenced by longer reaction time. So here EEG and eye tracking data were collected during the attention network test. And this is the raw EEG data and stimulus elicited event related potentials or ERP responses were too small to visualize within this much larger EEG. ERPs are electrical potentials in the brain that are elicited by stimulus. In order to visualize them, we then simply averaged across all the subjects' averaged waveform and created grand averaged ERP waveforms. And the resulting averaged ERP waveform consists of sequence of positive and negative voltage deflection, which are called as components or peaks. The components are labeled as P1, N1, P2, N2, and so on. P denotes positive going component and N denotes negative going component. The number indicates a component's latency. Here, ERP provides a continuous measure of processing of a cue, target stimulus, and response, which making it possible to determine which stage or stages of processing are influenced by the attention. In the framework of attention network experiment, children must report the direction of the center fish among flankers. Children were slower when the center fish was in the opposite direction of the flankers, which we observed in the reaction time performance. And it is difficult to answer many questions simply by looking at the reaction time performance. But the studies of N1 and P3 component have been very useful in addressing various issues. Therefore, we examine the attentional subprocesses at the ERP level. This is the grand average ERP waveform for alerting subprocess, that is double cued versus non-cued target stimulus. Cue stimulus is onset at 0 millisecond and target stimulus onset is at 500 millisecond. Now our focus is on the target related N1 amplitude. Generally, behavioral effects of alerting and orienting are accompanied by modulation of posterior visual N1 amplitude around 100 to 280 milliseconds. This could be visualized at the topo plots for non-cue target stimuli and double cue target stimuli during N1 period. The red color waveform show posterior electrode at the right hemisphere and black color waveform show posterior electrode in the left hemisphere. The enhanced N1 for double cue target stimulus in the alerting subprocess, which indicates more efficient processing of the target stimulus following specific warning cues. Similarly to alerting, orienting also enhanced the target related N1 when it was spatially cued. The primary goal of the source localization is to identify where in the brain a particular type of brain activation originates based on the scalp level EEG recording. In this research work, we were interested to understand where a target N1 and P3 related responses come from. We used distributed source model called Clara and age appropriate FEM head model of 12 year old template. After performing source localization at N1 period, we observed activations in these regions. Alerting network showed effect in the right and left occipital lobes and right anterior temporal lobes. Now, orienting network showed effects in the right and left occipital areas. And the activity in the left and right occipital lobes were interpreted as enhanced visual processing for target stimulus appearing in the cued location. The activation of the right anterior temporal region is linked to alertness in the brain in response to warning signal. This is the grand averaged ERP waveform for inhibition subprocess, that is incongruent versus congruent target. We did source localization at P3 latency. As a result, we observed these neuronal sources during P3 period. And the significant ones are medial prefrontal cortex and left anterior temporal lobe. A larger neuroimaging studies have revealed that the prefrontal cortex is involved in resolving conflicts. Evidences from previous fMRI study on children also supported our results that left temporal lobe is strongly associated with response inhibition. We used brain sources derived from typically developing children and tested how those brain areas differ in children with attentional problems or children with reading difficulties using source current density. Source current density is a group of mathematical algorithms that transform the scalp recorded electrical activity into estimates of current flow at scalp level. As a result, children with attentional problem showed a larger alerting effect, that is double cued versus non cued target stimulus in the left occipital lobe compared to control children and children with reading difficulties. Children in the control group showed a smaller orienting effect, that is spatially cued versus center cued target stimulus in the left occipital lobe compared to children with attentional problem and children with reading difficulties. And no differences were observed between groups for the neuronal sources associated with the innervation network. And the next work in my doctoral study is on time frequency analysis of EEG. It tells us which frequency have the most or least power at the specific point in time. It is often assumed that changes in EEG power reflect underlying changes in neuronal synchrony. And this is the topographic distribution of the power spectrum over theta band for alerting subprocess at 300 milliseconds after cue onset. And this is the distribution of power spectrum at the electrode in the right occipital area. We can see that the theta power is increased during the pre-target period. The increased theta power during cueing period is linked to focused attention processing. A possible reason for the increase in theta band power could be that double cue enhanced the alertness in the children. And this is the topographic distribution of the power spectrum at 300 milliseconds after target onset. It showed decreased theta power during the target onset in the parieto-occipital area as a result of alertness. As a summary of this research work, we examined the attentional subprocesses in typical and atypically developing children using reaction time performances, event-related potential, neuronal sources, and time frequency power spectrum. And the findings of this research showed that typical and atypically developing children exhibit the same level of reaction time performance during attention network task in a controlled experimental environment. And the ERP results suggested that atypical group children also process the cued target in a similar pattern to typical children. Whereas at the neuronal source level, it revealed how the brain regions were different between the groups. Lastly, time frequency power spectrum analysis reflected the distinct neuronal activity associated with attentional subprocesses and its functional significances. The future research could involve implementation of advanced level source analysis, including individual level MRI data and high density of EEG, with additional analysis of brain connectivity would provide a better understanding of the neuronal dynamics of attentional subprocesses in children. And time frequency analysis could be carried out in atypical group to examine the differences from different perspective. Furthermore, the longitudinal follow-ups and examining the attentional subprocesses effect the development of other areas of cognition such as reading, speech perception, and social cognition. Teachers and special education workers could benefit from this research as a means of strengthening specific models in the curriculum, thereby enhancing children learning efficiency. Thank you. May I ask you, honored Professor Minna Huottilainen, as the opponent appointed by the faculty, to present the comments on my dissertation that you see justifiable.
Thank you. I feel really honored to act as an opponent today for this thesis. Today is the day of Minna Kant. She was a strong female thinker and cultural figure, so it's very appropriate that Mr. Santana Gopalan is defending his thesis today. Minna Kant was a student of Jyväskylä Teacher Seminar, right where you are now, which is now called Faculty of Education and Psychology at University of Jyväskylä. The candidate has been studying attention and its sub-processes. He has been studying attention in typically developing children, but also in children who have varying problems in reading, problems in controlling their attention. The thesis is entitled Attentional Subprocesses in Typical and Atypically Developing Children as Revealed Using Brain Electrical Activity. The thesis is composed of three studies. Two of them are already published, one in Scientific Reports and the other one in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience. And the third one is submitted for review and publication process. In addition, the candidate has produced 50 pages of scientific text explaining the scientific background, the methods, the results. And he's also discussing the results in his very interesting thesis. So I'm happy now to proceed to the actual questions. My first question is about the choice of methods. You have chosen to use the brain electrical activity to study attention. There are, of course, many different ways to study attention, and this is one of them, the same one that I've also chosen. So I would like to ask you, what are the benefits of using the brain electrical activity in these types of studies?
Yes. Thank you for the question and sorry for the interruption. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Ah, yes. Thank you. Yes. Okay. Yes, I think there are many studies which they have used fMRIs and then reaction time to study the attention and attentional subprocesses. So we would like to use this EEG event related potentials. So this could help us to understand even in depth. So what is happening during the entire course of task, for example, when they are seeing the cue and when they are responding and then how they are processing it. So it helps us to understand in depth apart from the behavioral reactions and how it is happening. So that's one of the reasons to use event related potentials.
Yes, it's very difficult to study the underlying systems of attention without using some measures of brain activity. You have also chosen a very bold goal in your thesis to look at the psychological theory of attention and try to find event-related potentials and paradigms of event-related potential studies where you could actually align these psychological theories, the three subcomponents, and then the ERP components, which of course differ a lot from these psychological theories. This is not an easy task. So it means that there has to be a paradigm that functions in such a way that enables us to see these three subcomponents. Do you think that it was a successful paradigm in your case? And what would you have done if you couldn't see all of the three subcomponents?
Yes, thank you so much for the question. Yes, actually this paradigm is one of the famous and most of the people who are working on the attention network, it's one of the strongest influence on it. And then that's why we chose this paradigm, this attention network test. And then in this, we can study three sub-processes, even different things in one experiment. In the initial phase, when they were doing this piloting data, at that time, even with 10 trials, we could see the ERP effect. So this experiment is very well suited, and it is well known for studying this attention network. So it is working really good, and it was working when we started the initial phase itself. And that's why we also added eye tracking data in order to see, because it's a visual task, in order to make it more efficient of this task. So that's why we thought this task is really suitable to study attention network.
So it was actually quite good luck also for the psychological mm-hmm. theories to fit together with the ERPs. I'm thinking here about some cases, for example, in memory research, mm-hmm. with some old influential psychological theories on memory. And then we have, on the other side, we have this ERP research on memory, and sometimes they just don't fit together.
Yes.
And of course, this happens because the psychological theories, they were constructed on the basis of without having knowledge of how the brain actually works. And now when we are gaining more information about the brain processes, so we also may need to change or maybe reiterate a little bit some of the old psychological theories. But in your case, there was no need for this. So you think that the ERP findings are well fitted with the theory?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I think there is also, would like to add one more point to that. Yes, there is lots of discussion about this, like connecting this attention with working memory and those things. Yeah. And they also try to connect this with the short-term memory and everything. Yes, I think there are some discussion about this and then trying to connect. Yes, that's kind of future work also.
I also have a question about the clinical world in attention research. If we think about the clinical findings in attention, so those paradigms and those neuropsychological tests that look for problems in attention in school children like these ones who were around 12 years of age, so they are not actually directly placing this study on the same psychological theory as the ERP studies are.
Yes.
What would you say about this difference?
Yes, I think this is this research work is a first step to understand how the attention is working in children and also in children with learning problems like ADHD or dyslexic, something like that. Because, in the current days, most of the children are using this internet and other online medias to study. So in that case, attention plays a major role. So this would help to understand what it is, and still a few things need to be ticked to know how we can relate, because this is an indirect results and it is hard for the teachers to interpret how they can do it. But this could be used in a future curriculum, like how to interpret for the children, like what they can use it. For example, when they are doing for attention or alerting, so how we can give cues, for example, spatial cues, if the children are having some issues, okay, creating the task in the class to study with cues, and then like innovation or something like that. So that could be implemented for children in the future.
Yes, that sounds very, very important. Mm-hmm. So let's go now to chapter 1.2, where you are defining the sub-processes of the visual attention network. It would be nice to hear with your own words what you actually mean with alerting, orienting, and inhibition in this
yes.
study.
Yes. Yes. So my definition for alerting, orienting, and inhibition, right?
Yes.
Okay. So alerting is like you are like giving, getting prepared for something and then to do some task. So it's alerting, and orienting is like changing your orientation, or you want to see something and then you change your focus from one place to another place with the cue or without the cue, something like that. And for innovation, it's like, okay, there are like so many things, but you want to focus on only one thing, but that's also distracting. So you want something like suppressing the unwanted information or irrelevant information.
Yes. So if we take an example from the classroom, we have a 12-year-old boy sitting close to the window, and the teacher has given him a task that he's supposed to be drawing or writing something in his book. And then what happens is that there's a bird flying across the window. And of course, he's distracted by this, and he turns his head towards the window, and he forgets what he was doing. And it takes some time for him to figure out that, oh, it was only a bird. So actually, I can go back to my original task. So which subcomponents of attention would you see in that kind of situation?
I think it's inhibition, because it's distracted and irrelevant to the task.
Yes. So these are
from teacher's point of view, that is irrelevant, because students should focus class. Yes.
So it is some kind of distraction that is very typical, of course, in our environment, and it is crucial to notice that your attention was slipping, and then also it's really important to be able to focus your attention back to the original task. But you wouldn't maybe see alerting in that situation, because there was already a task. Alerting would be when you are waiting for a task, isn't it?
Yes. If the teacher is giving some input that, for example, if there is some, for example, auditory attention or something like that, teacher is giving something, then in that case, we could say alerting is also involved. In addition, for example, if the teacher is using some sticks or some pointer towards the boat, then it's orienting, so giving the cues, okay, focus here specifically. So if we have these things, then all three are covered in the classroom.
Yes. So it's nice sometimes to try to take these theories a little bit closer to the to the actual situations in schools, for example, where these children are needing these attentive skills. So on this chapter 1.3, you are explaining all of these brain-evoked potentials that you have been using in this task. And some of these peaks are heavily related to the stimulation that you are using. And some of the peaks are more related to the task that the children are working on. So would you please classify these peaks according to the ones where the stimulus is more important and the ones where the task is more important?
Yes. Okay. So in this research, we are interested in two components, ERP components. One is N1 and one is P3. So, and moreover, we are interested in the target related N1 period and then P3. So target related P3. So N1 period, target related N1 period, it's influenced when there is a cue. So for example, when we want to study this alerting effect, so we use two condition, that is no cue versus double cue. For example, there is a center fish, the stimulus, and it is followed without any cue. And the other condition is there will be double cues before the flankers. So that will give alertness. So based on this, there will be like a ER when the target appears, at that point, the EN1 appears. So we are interested in that N1 period. So what is happening and how they are processing, whether this N1 period could reveal this cueing enhance their effect, or how the children are utilizing this cue. And similarly, we want to see this P3 during the innervation period. For example, when the stimulus, all the fish going in the same direction, that is congruent. If the center fish going in the opposite direction, it is incongruent. So using these two conditions, we studied innervation subprocess at that point at the P3 period, that is around like after 300 milliseconds from the target onset, and how they are responding. So it tells us how they are resolving the conflicts and how they are like discriminating the difference between the target and then the flankers.
So if you would have an experiment which would have exactly the same stimulus as you had, but the only task for the child would be just to look at the screen, try to focus on the point in the middle of the screen. Yes. So How do you think that your ERPs would look like in that kind of experiment?
Yes, thank you very much for this question. Yes, I think we measured the eye tracking data meanwhile when we are recording this EEG data. So we made a fixation with the eye so that they need to see at the specific regions in the screen. For example, if their point is like somewhere outside the fixation point, then the next trial will not be proceeded during the experiment. So it is very obvious that they are seeing the fixation and seeing the screen. So yeah, that was one of the advantages of using eye tracking.
Yes, it's quite important to know that your participant is looking at what you mm-hmm. what you were instructing, and especially in the case of children.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the P3 component is elicited because the child is paying attention to the stimuli.
Mm-hmm.
What if the child was doing something else? Even though he was fixating on the fixation cross, he mm-hmm. would see the cues, he would see the fishes, but mm-hmm. he wouldn't care. He would mm-hmm. just be, for example, listening to a story on the background mm-hmm. or something like that. So yes. Would you then be able to see the P3 response at all?
Mm-hmm. I guess if they are not attending or not focusing on the task, I guess it will be like there will be some deflection in the P3 amplitude. So because there are some previous studies which have showed that, for example, in adult ADHD and dyslexic group, there is some effect in the P3 where their amplitude was decreased compared to the control group. So this might happen with the children.
So you would say that the N1 component would be more less affected P3. By the children's attention, mm-hmm. and then the P3 would be more affected.
That might happen because at least in our study, we didn't find any differences between the groups, because atypical group also did more or less the same thing, like what they did for the control group when we did the comparison between the groups. But this is just a guess if they are not doing it, because our task is more or less it's engaged. So that made the children to focus on it. For example, if they are taking their eye or something like that. So that might be one reason that we could see P3 normal, like a control group children.
Yes. So you would say that the N1 is like more automatic response compared to the P3?
Mm-hmm.
Does it happen? Is it elicited more automatically or like more stimulus driven way?
I think it's a stimulus driven because it's very systematic, and we can see that N1 effect for this alerting and orienting and all the cueing sub processes, and which we can see. I think it's driven by the stimulus, which we can see.
Yes. Then I would like to move over to page 17, where you are talking about the time frequency analysis as a technique. And this is, of course, a way to look at the electroencephalogram from a very different point of view compared to the event-related potentials. So yes. Would you please explain the difference between the event-related potential and the time frequency analysis?
Yes. So the very first difference is event-related potential, we see the results in the time domain, and the time frequency, we see it in both in frequency power spectrum in the frequency domain and at a specific time. So it shows how the power changes in different frequencies at the specific time, because there we have only the time and amplitude, and here we have the power and specific frequency and time. So here we have more components to see.
Yes. So I would like to ask about the temporal accuracy of these mm-hmm. two methods. So mm-hmm. if you think about a specific moment in time, let's say 100 milliseconds after you presented the fish picture. So how specific are the event-related potentials and the time frequency analysis in response to this one moment in time?
I think both we can see in the time frequency, it's still more give additional information, and then we can see kind of how it varies during the time period, even in a very different frequencies. So,
yes. So it is quite typical also to use some kind of a window in the analysis. So if you think about the time windows that you would use for analyzing, for example, some ERP components, like for example, the N1, you might choose a window of 50 milliseconds or 20 milliseconds, or in some cases, 100 milliseconds. What about in the time frequency analysis?
Yes.
Do you also use time windows for the analysis?
Yes. Oh, yeah. When we want to study this N1 time period, we were restricted with a specific time point, for example, 150, 200 milliseconds, something like that. We want to see the effect. But when we want to study this time frequency analysis, it is always recommended to have larger time window so that there won't be like this adding zeros or something like zeros, and then there are like some technical that zero padding and aliasing effect or something like that. So it's always recommended. So that's why in the third paper we tried to have us like whole time window, so where we can see also the queuing period and target period. So we didn't restrict the time window there.
Yes, so the time windows in the time frequency analysis have to be longer, otherwise we would have to be aliasing the responses from the previous and future time moments together. And does this depend on the frequency band that you are looking at, the length of the time window?
Yes. Actually, that is also a matter, because, for example, if I want to see some specific frequency band and then the time window is shorter or longer, so that is also indirectly or directly affect. So that's why we use this technique called zero padding, so that will be balanced when we are choosing a specific frequency, even though our time windows, compared to other time frequency analysis studies, this is a comparatively small time window, our task, like what we are seeing, like, I think 1,200 epochs for alerting and orienting, and for innovation, it's like 900 millisecond epochs. So that's quite shorter. So we add this zero padding. So that will be balancing this kind of issues.
So then it would mean that when you are looking at the very lowest frequency bands, so then you would actually need to have also the longest time windows for the time frequency analysis.
Yes. So
it means that the information from that frequency is actually more spread over time. Mm-hmm. So you actually cannot study a very, very narrow time window for that purpose. So these time frequency phenomenon must be kind of slower than the ones that you study in the ERPs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so the time frequency is slower, true.
Yes, it is some kind of a event at the neural level that is not phase locked to the stimulus. So it's quite easy to understand the actual kind of temporal coupling of the ERPs and the stimulus. If you think about the neural circuitry, you have the stimulus coming, the retina is picking it up, and there is a cascade of events continuing every time the same way, because all of that is very stimulus driven. They are very simple events that are occurring across the visual pathway, and even at the visual cortex, a very kind of specific event when the information from the visual stimulus enters the visual cortex. But these time frequency phenomenon are different, because they must be somehow related to what is going on in the visual cortex at the moment when the stimulus is actually entering and coming in, what is happening there, and how the stimulus is somehow reacting and affecting the activity, the previous activity in the visual areas. So that may be the reason why some of these phenomena are slower or more spread over in time. Is there any studies about the differences within each stimulus, within each epoch, in the event-related potentials and in the time frequency analysis. I know there are some for the ERPs that there is a lot of variation in the individual epochs, but what about for the time frequency?
Mm-hmm. I think we also focused on this point, whether it is a stimulus driven or it is like something like internally driven task or something like that. So these could be studied using this time frequency analysis. So that's why we use this two different methods to study this time frequency analysis. One is like event related phase lock and induced phase lock method. So we want to test whether it is driven by the stimulus or how it is driven, whether it is an internal process because of the visual stimuli and how they are processing it. Yes. And there are some studies which they compare between these two different methods, like the induced one and then the event related non-phase locked one, those things. There are some studies, but it is a compare in terms of this attention network task, it is quite less. They have used something like a working memory task or something like that.
Yes. So maybe we can now go over to the second part of the thesis, the methods part. And yes. This is now first starting with the participants of your studies. So these participants were 12 and 13 year old children. Mm-hmm. And you are writing here that the participants and their parents or guardians signed an informed consent form in accordance with the Declaration of Helsinki. So I would like to ask you about this declaration. What are the most important parts of this declaration? Of course, signing the consent or giving the consent orally, mm-hmm. but there are also other parts in the declaration. Do you know those?
I don't know what are the things officially in the Declaration of Helsinki, but I think I can guess those things based on the research ethics and theory of science, those studies. I can say that the data should be protected and the identity should not be revealed unless if you get concern from the people and the protection of the data. So these kind of things are there.
Yes, of course, that's true. What does this informed consent mean? So you probably had some kind of information sheet for the parents and children.
So it's like a pamphlet giving them what we are doing, like in a very layman term, like, so what we are doing and why we are doing. So who will be the audience like from this research? So what we might get, something like that. And also giving them an acknowledgement that we will use this data for this much time and then we will destroy it and the identity will not be revealed. And in case if they want to use it for the follow-up or longitudinal study, so they will ask them, okay, this is the study. So these kind of information will be there. And also asking, for example, asking their background, like questions, background questions. So family background, whether they have like dyslexia or any neurological disorders or something like that. So these things will be covered in the informed consent.
There's also one point in Declaration of Helsinki, and this is the rights of the participant to quit his participation at any time that he wants to do that. So did this happen in your study? Did anybody just announce that, no, I don't want to continue?
I think one or two, I remember they were like so tired, so they want to go. And some stories also happened, like few people, they didn't feel well and something happened, so they left, remember?
Yes. I think it's a sign of a good ethics in a study if you have participants who are leaving in the middle of the study, because this means that they have known their rights and they mm-hmm. have had the feeling that they can actually say that they don't want to continue. So that's one which I consider really important when we are studying children, that mm-hmm. we have to be at the appropriate level explaining the study to them, but also explaining their rights, that they actually mm-hmm. have the right to quit if they don't want to continue, even though they just said a while ago that they want to participate, but still they have the right to quit. 12-year-olds are already old enough to understand this, but of course when we are studying younger children, so it's sometimes quite difficult to try to figure out whether they actually understand what their rights are. So you have quite a large group of participants, 466 children participating mm-hmm. In the first ESEEK study from which yes. then these participants came. So that's a large population. How did yes. you choose the participants for these ERP yes. studies?
So this was done in three cohort, like in 2 years or 2 to 3 years task. So they started in 2015 and I joined this project the mid of 2015. So when I joined the team at that time itself, they're like started the project. So first they went to the schools and then they did this ILA test, like internet reading assessment test. And also they did this shortened Raven score matrix test. And the students who completed these tests, they were invited for EEG measurement. And then after that, the EEG measurement were done. And then we used criteria to group them.
And in your groups, I think everybody notices quite easily that there is a gender unbalance in one of the groups. So
yes.
the children with the attentional problems, most of them are actually boys. Do you want to say something about this?
Yes. Actually, we would like to increase the number of participants for the attentional problem and reading difficulties. That was really a challenging task to get these number of participants. And so I think that's a limitation in my studies. We try to increase the count, but unfortunately we can't get it. But that's there. There is an imbalance in the gender for the two groups.
So does it mean that the group who could have participated in this attentional problem group of children mainly consisted of boys?
Sorry, could you repeat?
I mean that when you are inviting these participants, when you mm-hmm. invite somebody, not all of them come, of course, so this is normal that they mm-hmm. just refuse. But the ones who you were able to invite, so mm-hmm. was it in that group that it was mainly boys?
I think it also include girls also, but the majority was boys, if I remember correctly. Yes, majority were boys.
Why do you think most of them are boys?
I think there are also some studies they were checking, because when I had this imbalance in this, and there was also some studies that boys have more influence, all this ADHD, they have this deficit. Maybe that could be one reason, but we don't have any statistics here to conclude that, so that might be a reason.
Yes. So this yes. study that they participated in, this ESEEK study, so that was also looking at their attentional skills. And mm. then there was a majority of the ones who got the lowest grades in that subtest were boys. And mm-hmm. I think this is quite typical for many attention studies, that you mm-hmm. You tend to get boys into those mm-hmm. those studies, and you have to look for the girls and try to convince them also to come.
Yes.
But it's very difficult to do anything to this matter, because you are recruiting from a pool of participants who are mainly boys, so then you will be getting mainly boys. They were on the sixth grade, if I understand correctly, mm-hmm. between
yes.
12 and 13 years old.
Yes.
So they participated in this ESEEK study in their own classroom. Did they do it at school?
Yes. So they had the settings in the school. So it's like a group session. Some tests were in the group session and some tests they were invited and individually.
So the teacher was the one who was performing this testing for them, mm-hmm. or was there a researcher in the classroom?
Yes, I think the researcher were also there in the class, and the teacher were rating it, like based on they have given the like more than like 55 items rating score, so they need to mark it, like what's the each student value, like how they behave or something like that. Yes.
Yes, and then there was this in chapter 2.2. You are explaining these behavioral measures that were used in the articles. So these are all tests that that are done one-on-one or as a group. Here is the reading fluency performance and mm-hmm. the ATEX test and the visual spatial.
Yes, I think this word identification test, word chain test, those are done in a group. And then this oral pseudo text reading, that is like an individual one.
Yes. So after all of this testing, so then the children came to the experimental part, to this neuroscientific part. Yes. And this was all of this work was done in one session, wasn't it? So how long did it take for the children to spend time in the laboratory?
Mm-hmm. I think one task for this only, this attention task, because when they are coming, we had like ESIC had like four different sub projects. So this is just one project in it. And this task took approximately like 28 to 35 minutes or something like that. Yeah, between this time and how fast they are responding.
Yes, of course, yes. How long does it take to put on the EEG electrodes and the eye tracker and everything?
Yes. So I think it took something like 15 minutes or something like that, less than 15 minutes, because when we know that the participants are coming, we already put it in the electrolyte gel and then keep everything ready as much as, because we don't want the participant to get tired, because this might make them so tired. Most of the children came after the school, so it's already, we can see that they are tired and then sometimes leaning on the rest. So those things needs to be considered carefully. So that's why we made it as fast as possible, so they can't, they will not get tired quickly.
And was this the first one that they participated in? You said that there were four different experiments. So.
I think this is the third project, because we recorded four at the same. Most of the things were same time, or sometimes two tasks, and then after that we recorded. But this is the third task.
Okay. And was it difficult for them to use the eye tracker and to keep their gaze focused in the fixation point?
I think they got, because we had like 6 to 7 practice trials, something like that. Yeah, I think they got used to it.
Yes. And they have a chin rest like this?
Yes, they had chin rest.
Yes. Well, yes. So how did they like that one?
I think some people really enjoyed it, and some kids, they were like leaning on one side. So one side of the EEG were like distorted and lots of noise.
Yes, I've seen that too. So in this part 2.5, where you are explaining the pre-processing of the EEG and eye tracking data, so you mentioned that you were interpolating some of the raw EEG channels that had some problems or were some bad channels or something like that. So how common was that? How many channels on average did you need to interpolate?
Yes. I think we don't want to, we were very careful when we are doing interplotting, so it will not create this kind of hole. So we making interplotting the based on the neighbor channel. So we don't want to do that. So we were very careful in that aspect as well. So I think the most will be something like one or two subject close to 8-9, but the rest mostly it will be like less than 5, not that many. Only few subjects, they were like more than 10 electrodes were interplotted, and that too we checked very carefully that it is not happening in very nearby electrodes that it is getting interplotted or something like that.
Yes, so if you would have like two electrodes that are close to each other and both of them happen to have some bad data, so what would you do in that kind of situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in that situation, if there are like two electrodes, then we need to make one electrode definitely interplotted, and then another one we need to see how the data is fluctuating. So which one is having the very bad signal, so then choose that one and then see.
Yes. What about the channels which don't have neighboring electrodes, like the ones that are lowest in the mm-hmm. cap? So yes. What would you do if those would have bad data?
Yes, actually those electrodes were a little bit bad, and then we checked, because we are interested in this N1 and then P3 window. So we chose that window and then see how the data is there, if it is like very distorted or something like that. But these are done after the pre-processing, even if there is a very high jump, because these electrodes are very crucial. So we tried to make it as a short time window and then see is there, and we use this amplitude thresholding technique. So seeing the fluctuation, like how large it is. So based on that, also we rejected some trials, and also we checked the electrodes like that as well.
Yes. So it's always a problem when we are studying children. They may have so many different kinds of causes for noise for the data. So what would you say that were the most typical reasons why you had to interpolate some channels?
Where does the
noise come from? Do you think it's mainly like movement of the child, or is it more like bad impedance of the channels? Or
Yes, I think it's mostly because of their movement. At least in our data, they were like moving sometimes and then shaking because they need to keep all the time like 20 minutes in. But of course, after every block, we gave some rest. But still, some kids, they can't handle it for the longer time. So mainly it was from the movement, and also somewhere like the noise, maybe their hand movement and they're moving here. So something like that, the movement noise was there, and also a little bit about the muscle artifacts as well.
Yes. So they may have like frowning their eyebrows or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then that would be causing some muscle artifacts in the frontal channels. But maybe the frontal channels are actually not so important in this study. Or what do you think?
I think that is also important, the frontal channels, because we in the latest stage, we are going to study the neuronal sources using this EEG data and everything. So we are going to do this inverse problem there as well. So I think it is also important, but we use this eye tracking data so that it is easier whether there is some eye blinks or eye movements or something like that. So that also helped because that... For example, if there is a blink or something like that, that will be reflected in the eye tracking data. The voltage will be reducing to zero, like the value will be reducing to zero. So that helps us also whether they are seeing it or not. And also these things will help to check the quality of the frontal electrode and their eye movement and everything.
So then when you had eye movements eye blinks when the child was blinking during the epoch, so what did you do? Did you try to remove the blink or did you just throw that epoch away?
Yes, I think during the specific time, for example, we had those epochs. So in that specific epoch time where we are interested, like N1 period, if at that point, children did some eye blinks, then the value will be reducing. So we, based on that time window, we removed those trials, but it was not that many trials were removed. So we tried to make some threshold, like something like a minimum 30 trials based on the previous studies also, because most of the studies, they had minimum at least 30 trials, but we had most of the case, we had more than like 70% of the trials were there when we are doing this averaging, single subject averaging, we had that.
Yeah, that sounds very reasonable. You are explaining here also about the synchronization of the EEG and the eye tracking data. So can you explain what that means? Because you have a stimulation equipment that is sending the trigger pulses to the EEG and also trigger pulses to the eye tracker. So what do you actually have to synchronize?
Yes. For example, when we see our experiment, this ant experiment, at every event, we have the triggers. For example, the starting point, we had triggers. And then when the cue, when the fixation and when the response, we had each point the triggers. And similarly, at the same time, when we are recording the EEG eye tracking data, there are also like triggers, the starting and ending point for each trials, the eye tracking also had the trigger. So we need to synchronize these two triggers so that it does not mismatch. So the eye tracking data and the EEG data, they are synchronized. So these things need to be like the time should be synchronized, that is matching.
Okay, so you are recording the triggers coming from the eye tracker.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And where do those triggers go?
So we use this EEG lab. EEG lab, there is an eye track toolbox. So use that. So we have like, for example, in the ant paradigm, we have events. And similarly, when we are recording simultaneously, those events were also recorded in the eye tracking. So because eye tracking is also recorded, then these two events, we need to match. Okay, for example, when the starting is something like one in the attention paradigm, and then in the eye tracking is also one. So these two events should match. And then we did this linear regression. Okay, how good it is matching. Those things were compared. Yes, that's what we did, synchronization.
Okay, so there's a lot of work actually to combine the EEG data mm-hmm. with the eye tracking data.
Yes. So my colleague, he's an expert in this eye tracking data. So he gave good support in this.
So then you can see what the child is looking at. And mm-hmm. if the child is not looking at the fixation point and he's not looking at the fish that he's supposed to be looking at, so mm-hmm. what do you do with those trials?
Yes. So for example, at that time, we know the fixation point pixel where in the screen, and then we use some threshold, for example, 200 millisecond or 500 millisecond away from this fixation. If the child fixation is not in this specific region, then we remove those trials.
And how many did you have to remove because the child was not looking at the fixation? How typical was that?
I think in the control group, there was not that many trials that we need to reject. But for in this attention problem and reading difficulties, there were many subjects that we need to remove. And that's why, because we plan to add also this comorbidity group as well. But when we are doing all these things, the number of trials were very less and the participant number were very less. That's why we didn't have that group. So this issues were raised when we are dealing with that.
I can imagine what happened. So you had this group of children with problems in reading, and those children didn't have attentional problems, but mm-hmm. still they had problems in directing their eye gaze because you mm-hmm. had to throw out so many of those mm-hmm. Trials. So what do you think about that? Is it an attentional problem, or is it related to the reading difficulty?
I think I can't say anything very precisely, but I think it might be because of their attention, I guess, because they can't continuously watch the screen and then can't focus. So that could be something related to that.
Yes, it could be something related to specifically focusing your gaze to a relevant thing that is appearing mm-hmm. screen or maybe on the paper. So this would be a sub-process of attention, but it would also be sub-process of reading skills. So it is quite difficult to actually separate those from each other. So that was just a side issue. We were talking about the processing of the data. So I would like to ask next about the length of the segments, the epochs that you were choosing.
Yes.
So you had this 1,200 millisecond epochs, and then you also had this 900 millisecond epochs. So how did you actually choose the length of the epoch?
We are interested in this N1 period. So for that, we want to see also the effect of the cue, how it is having. But of course, we want to study the target period. And that's why we choose like minus 200 millisecond for the baseline, like 200 millisecond before the cue onset, and then 500 millisecond during the cue period, and then 500 millisecond after the target period. So that's 1,200 millisecond epoch. So we chose that. And then for the innervation period, we chose 900, that is 200 millisecond for the baseline, and 700 millisecond that is from the target onset. And of course, we also tested, we would like to see whether we can have more than 700 millisecond for the innervation. And there the problem comes because when we increase the epoch length, then there is more fluctuation, because once they respond and then they're like, there are noise and then there is a fluctuation because they know they already did the task and then they are relaxing. So there is a movement and there is a noise also, and there is a fluctuation. So that's why we tested till 900 millisecond, like from the target onset, and then we reduced it to 700 millisecond where we can have more number of trials. So that's how we end up this 1200 and 700, 900 milliseconds together, including baseline.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to be very picky about the duration of the mm-hmm. segment, because of course, when you are increasing the duration of the segment, you are always including more noise. And mm-hmm. if there is no signal in those areas, so then it doesn't make any sense to include them, but you still want to include all of those phenomena that you are studying. If you think about the ERPs, mm-hmm. We want every epoch to be as mm-hmm. clean as possible. And for them, we would like to make the epochs as short as possible so that they only include those moments in time what we are interested in. But if you think about the time frequency analysis, mm-hmm. So the time frequency analysis would, of course, benefit from longer windows. You wouldn't have so many artifacts of the cutting of the windows. So this is also some kind of a compromise. Or do you think that it would be possible to use different windows for the ERPs and for the time frequency analysis?
No, I think same window. For example, in our case, when we want to do this time frequency analysis, there was a feedback from the experts, and they also mentioned because your time window is very short to this time frequency analysis or something like that. But we use this BISA research where we have the compensate the zero padding technique, and that helped us a lot, so we don't need to take a longer time window. So that helped us to study and explore in the shorter time this time frequency analysis.
Yes, and of course it doesn't help the time frequency analysis if you prolong the epoch and you get some noise in from the end of the epoch, like the child pressing the button and then after the button press, maybe blinking or maybe doing something like, I had it right or something. So then you know that even that period will be full of artifacts which you don't want to include. So it is always a bit of a compromise. What about the filters? You were filtering the data, of course, for the ERPs. You are here explaining very carefully which types of filters you were using. But what about for the time frequency, do you have to leave out some of the filters or maybe use different kinds of filters than for the ERPs?
Yes. I think for the first two studies, we were testing different filters. For example, you can see the high pass filter. We did like 1 hertz and also 0.75 hertz. So we were testing. So which was giving the optimal data. So we tested this and then we found this 0.5 hertz. So that was tested in the field trip. And then we were checking so how efficient it is, like where we can get as much as the clean data. Then also we for this third study, we chose this bandpass filter like 1 to 100 hertz. So we thought because we are planning to study this the frequency till gamma, like higher gamma. So we thought, okay, it's better to have it as a more band, then it's easier for us. So that's why we chose like 1 to 100 hertz bandpass filter for that.
And did you have any problems with the 50 hertz noise?
Yes. I think we want to take those things. For example, first and second study, we managed. We don't want to do that because we already added during the pre-processing all those things that were handled. But when we want to do this time frequency analysis, we split exactly at that frequency. That's why we split the gamma into lower gamma and higher gamma. We don't want to see the effect of this noise. Of course, we tested it from like 40 to 80 hertz. We can clearly see that line noise. 50 hertz, then we split it like 30 to 45 hertz as a lower gamma and then 55 to 80 as a higher gamma.
This is a very practical and good solution to deal with the line noise. And very often you see that in the American papers, they are splitting it around 60 hertz because the line noise frequency is different. So that is affecting also our choices of methods. So then maybe we can move over to this chapter 2.6, where you are explaining the source analysis. And you were using this Loretta method, and it has now this Clara with a recursive system. Mm-hmm. So do you want to explain how it works in practice?
Yes, maybe briefly about this. Yes, this Clara method, I think it takes the neuronal sources, it finds the regions, and then get the sources related to each voxels, and then it will be recursively applied, whether it is a noise or something like that. So then the Clara will produce as a very focal source.
So the Clara is using the finite element model for the head model for the from the MRI. So this is coming from the 12-year-old.
Yes. So this is the template, which is already in the BISA research. So they implemented recently, like 2 years back when I started, like 3 years back, they started, and they have this different age template MRI data. So we used that. And unfortunately, in our research work, we had lack of resource to collect the individual MRI data. So we used this template 12-year-old to create this head model, which they already developed in the BISA research software, and then we used that.
So you don't know anything about the head size of the participants? Did you measure the head circumference?
Yes, I think it's something like 50 to 55, something like that, if I remember correctly.
And so it starts to be quite close already to the adult head. So the difference between the 12-year-old head size and the adult head size is surprisingly small, actually. But of course, the brain model is different because the brain is still developing. So especially some of the frontal parts of the brain actually don't look the same as they do in adults. So it's important to use the child model, even though the head sizes are already quite big. So what you are inserting in the model is the average data of all participants, isn't that so?
Yes.
So why don't you do it on the individual level?
Then
average the results of the Loretta?
Yes. Actually, thank you for this question, because the final aim, we want to do it as an individual level source localization. At least this result could help, because for example, when you are doing at the individual level source localization, at least in this data, there is a chance that we might leave some sources. So that's why we made a grand average and collapsed all the condition. And then we did the source localization at the specific N1 period and then specific P3 period, so that we are sure that this is, because we have a very large sample, and then it is really advantage for us to know what are the sources at the N1 period. So that's why we did it at the grand average level source localization. So we don't want to miss any sources and would like to give precise as possible, like the most sources, most active sources, major sources.
So when you are averaging together the data from a group of participants, so what do you think that are the noise sources that you are introducing? Of course, you are getting rid of some noise sources because you are bringing in data from many people, and maybe some small noises are averaged out in that process. But what are the types of noise sources that you are introducing in that situation?
Yes, I think this is, for example, there are some small other sources might be active. For example, when we are doing this grand average, and after that, when we are doing the source localization, we also observed some noises in the other regions, not on some activations in the other regions, for example, in the brain stem and something like that. So those are some of the issues from the algorithm, which they use it for the which they use it for calculating distributed model source localization. So what they do is, like, when there are like some other sources, they don't know where to put, that will be projected because it's a spherical shape, and then it will be projected in the brainstem. So these kind of noises, so for example, in the brainstem and then pons, so those things where we ignored it, because in the FAN study also, when they are doing this fMRI study, they also found these different other sources. So they ignored it when they want to do the source localization. So they ignored it. So we used that as a base. And then, so these kind of other noises were excluded for our study.
Okay. Something that I have seen in many, many situations is that when you look at the topographical map of one child's ERP data, you see a peak in some area. And then you look at the topographic map of another child, you see the same peak, but maybe it's not exactly in the same electrodes, maybe it's a little bit to the side or something like that. And when you then bring those together, what happens is that the peak on the topographical map doesn't look as sharp as it did in the individual maps. Mm-hmm. So yes, individual maps, the peaks are sharper, but they are not in the same place. And when you average it, you get a larger peak that is distributed over a larger area of electrodes. So what would that result in the Loretta model if the truth would be a sharp peak and what you insert in the model is a wider peak caused by the spatial averaging?
Yes, I think that is one of the limitation in the EEG, where they have poor spatial resolution. So I think in that case, we should use like MEG or something like that, where we can get more accurate data, like where exactly it is coming. So this could be one solution for that.
So these sharper peaks, they usually result in models where the sources are closer to the surface. And then with these wider peaks, they result in models where the activity actually looks like it's deeper in the brain, even though it would be closer to the surface. So the flattening of the topographical map may actually push your sources to the deeper parts of the brain, which may then actually not be true. And when I look at the figures, not only your figures, but also other figures from this Loretta method, so I very often see activity that is not actually cortical, but it's a little bit below the cortex. And my kind of personal interpretation is that it may be due to the fact that people are averaging across a large number of participants. This is something that it is a solution that we have to make, because as you said, if you try to do the Loretta on the individual participants, you again run into problems, unless you would have a very large amount of data from every single participant. But that's not possible practically, because we have to also keep our interest in the time that we are keeping the children in the laboratory, so we cannot keep them there for hours to get more epochs for our studies. I'm also interested in your opinion between the point-like source analysis, which used to be quite popular in ERPs. This was the dipole source analysis, and the comparison of those point-like and then the distributed ones that you have chosen.
Yes. I think in the dipole, that's another option, because in the dipole source localization, for example, if we see the previous studies, and most of the dipole source localization, they know where the sources, for example, in the auditory, they know it's like in the temporal regions or something like that. So then they can definitely sure that, okay, I'll place this two dipole here and I know how many sources are there. But in our case, this is like a visual stimuli and we are not sure how many sources are active. And of course, there are some studies like from the fMRI, there are so many regions are active. So that's why we thought, okay, let's go with the distribution source model and determine like how many sources were active. And then after that, we placed the regional source, because we don't know in which orientation the source is. So that's why we placed the regional source and extracted those source waveform and then did the statistics to find whether it's really an active source or it's something like a noise or something like that.
So if you are using the dipole model or some other point-like model, so then you would have to worry a lot about the direction of the source, because the direction would actually give you directly the topographical distribution of that source. But when you are looking at sources like these Loretta models, so then you don't have to worry about the direction at all. Mm-hmm. Yes. So where does the model actually calculate the direction of the distribution?
I am not sure about that. But I think it's something is happening in the Clara model, where they estimate all the sources, like it is making, it's calculating the at each voxel level and how the strength of the source. I think there it is happening, I guess, but I'm not sure about where exactly how they are calculating this the direction inside Clara.
So then when you are getting the data out from the distributed model, so you get the strength of the source and you of course get the distribution, the location of the source, but no direction. So that's of course a benefit for the model, because if you think about these minor differences in the folding of the cortex between some individual children, so then you would have to worry about those a lot if you are using the dipolar models. But if you are using the Loretta, so it is distributed, so it doesn't matter if there are some minor differences in the anatomy of the participants. So that's definitely a benefit. So my next question is about the chapter 2.7 about the time frequency analysis. Would you please explain the logic behind these dummy triggers that you
Yes.
I think this is very clever.
I was moving front and back between MATLAB field trip and visa. So I think in visa it was I did most of the pre-processing work in MATLAB. And then after taking the individual trials, when I want to import it to Beesa, because Beesa need a triggers so that it knows, because it will be like a one single data. So I need to insert some triggers where each trial it is. So what I did is I made some text file, because in Beesa you can insert a triggers manually if you are uploading some text file. So what I made is I know the epoch length of the each trial. So for each trial is like 9,200, and I know where the zero after every 200, like first trial after 200 milliseconds. So there is a starting point that's a zero. So, and then after the 1,000, and then after 1,000, there will be like 200, and again the next trial start. So, and I calculated that. Then I did this trigger numbers. So I put some dummy triggers, like something like one or something like whatever the trigger. And then now it, once I upload into Beesa, then it will be like all the trials, individual trials. So that's called the dummy trial. Then after that, I need to do this time frequency analysis in the Beesa. So this is the baseline zero, the trigger, where it is a trigger, that's a zero. And before that is a baseline. So from there, do all the calculation and set the time frequency. So that was the idea behind that dummy trigger.
Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Then you also mentioned that you were subtracting the evoked activity from the time frequency spectrum.
Yes.
So can you explain why you want to do that?
Yes. Yeah. So we want to see the induced effect also. So what we did, taking the each trial, and then in each trial, we subtracted the average of the trial response. And then we see whether it is like an induced or how the effects are changing, because we want to see the event-related phase lock and also this induced non-phase lock activity. So in order to study this, we want to remove that averaged activity from each trial, and then we tested that.
So you know that the evoked activity also has its own time frequency spectrum, and you can calculate that and you can subtract it so that you are only seeing this non-phase locked activity in the final frequency spectrum. Yes, that's very interesting, because otherwise you would be putting together things that are actually related to the ERPs. Okay, so then let's move over to the results part. And first, I would like to ask you to summarize about the reaction times. So how do you think that the results of the reaction times are actually reflecting the three components of attention?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay, so we calculated this alerting effect, orienting effect, and also this inhibition effect. And these effects were calculated by comparing the two conditions. For example, this alerting, we compared no cue versus double cue. And then for orienting, we compared center cue versus spatially cued. And for inhibition subprocess, we compared incongruent versus congruent. So we would like to see how they are effectively using these cues. For example, in the alerting and orienting, how they are effectively using the cues to resolve the target. So we measured the reaction time when they responded when these cues. So they are like around the trials were pseudo randomized, and then we extracted. And then when we are giving this double cue, so the reaction time is much faster compared to no cue. And similarly, when it is spatially cued also, they are giving faster reaction time. So that means that the children are utilizing the cue, so they know where the target is going to appear. So that made the smaller, like very faster reaction time. And then for the incongruent, they had some difficulties because there was like center fishes always in the opposite direction of the flankers. So they can't differentiate or discriminate between the, they had some difficulties. So that made them to take longer time to respond. So it's very sure that they have some difficulties for the incongruence. And then these results were also compared in the sense like literature wise, we compared with the adult. So how it is showing. So something like that we did.
Yes. So these reaction times results, they actually show that your paradigm was working.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
As you were hoping for. So then in figure two, you are showing these nice topographical maps and ERPs of these three different components of the attention. And If you look at the topographical maps, you can maybe see that alerting and orienting, they seem to be causing a lot of changes in the potential in the back of the head, while when you look at the inhibition, you see a very different pattern. There is a strong difference at the central mm-hmm. and frontal parts. So would it be possible already from these figures to conclude that alerting and orienting visual stimuli would be more responsibility of the visual cortical areas, while inhibition would then be more responsibility of more like central or frontal areas?
Yes, definitely we could speculate from this topography. Okay, so because we can see the activity in the occipital and periotonal occipital areas for alerting and orienting. So definitely, okay, so this is like some visual task. So something is happening in the occipital area. Definitely we can speculate the source, like neuronal source, what is happening. There's some neuronal sources from this topography as well.
Yes, so it's not a direct implication, but it's something that is kind of hinting towards that possibility.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then when we want to look at these table two is showing these actual sources. So here mm-hmm. actually we can see what I was already talking about, this depth of the sources. For example, the occipital sources, we would probably assume them to be on the occipital cortex. Mm-hmm. And they are maybe 1.5 centimeters or 2 centimeters mm-hmm. deeper than the occipital cortex. So do you think that this depth of the source is actually accurate, or what do you want to say about it?
Yes, I think it's hard to say it's accurate or not, because we are using a template MRI data and then we are using those electrode positions. So those electrode positions are like a standard one. So those things plays really a major role to say whether these sources are accurate or not. But the main aim or the objective of this work could be like giving a rough idea, like the first step, okay, these sources play a major role. So that's why we don't want to give a very specific region. For example, of course, I think that could be somewhere like fusiform gyrus or something like that. So we don't want to give more precise what region it is. So we try to be at a very, like very normal, like a very top level, like saying it's okay, it's like an occipital lobe or something like that. And definitely, so this could give some ideas. For example, if you want to do this individual level source localization, so this might help. So, okay, these regions, there are something when they are using this kind of template model, something.
Yes, that would be very helpful. Then in your second study in figure four, so you are also showing these source current density differences. So this is yes, now yes. The strength of the source. So
yes, strength of the
this
source.
Plus and minus mean actually here.
Yes. So what we did is we took the source strength and then we made as an average value, like we calculated the source strength average. Sometimes the value will be like plus and sometimes will be negative, either in the direction. So that's why it is like fluctuating, like either in the positive or negative. It might be in the any direction in the comparison, for example, either in the double Q and no Q. So that's this plus and minus.
Okay. And these differences between the control children and the two other groups, they are significant?
Yes. So we found only the significant effect in the left occipital lobe for alerting and orienting, and we didn't find any activation, like significant activation in the inhibition for inhibition subprocess.
So actually, the alerting is not different between the control children and the children with the reading difficulties. So it's only different with the children with attentional problems. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Control is only with the attentional problem. And then the difference is between the control and the reading difficulties, yes.
Yes. And then when you look at the orienting, so there you can see that the control children are actually the different ones. So, or you could say that the two other groups are different from the controls. So there is a different pattern here. And how would you interpret this pattern?
Yes, actually, when we see the previous literature, when they are comparing this different atypical group, there is a mixture of results. For example, some studies also show there is no differences between the control and atypical group. And some studies, for example, in the dyslexia, they showed they have some deficits in the occipital lobe or something like that. And then they said it's a secondary deficit area for dyslexic kids, this left occipital area. So that could be one reason for children having this reading difficulties. So that could be one. And then also, for example, in the alerting, the children were having some issues. So that could be related to some they can't process the they can't maintain the alertness, something like that.
Yes, so it's a very different kind of a component of the attention, this alerting and orienting, and maybe this orienting is more related again to the gaze direction and this kind of minor details of how the children are able to move their eyes and understand what they are actually seeing on the screen. So that's really quite important for future studies to continue with this. So then in the final paper, in study three, in this figure five, you are presenting the time frequency spectrum in the form of these permutation tests.
Yes.
So would you care to explain these scales? Because I'm quite interested in why sometimes the powers are very, very small, like for example, in the case of the theta power in alerting, and sometimes in alerting this, for example, lower gamma is very large. So
yes,
where does this scale come from?
Yes, I was trying to show when I was trying to present this figure, I was trying to set same scale for each topo plot. And then in that case, it's really tough because you can see that one was higher and then the one was lower. So that's why I thought, okay, we need to show the effect clearly. And because the different frequency, they can't show the power, like it's varying power. So each frequency have their different power. So that's why I thought it's better to have like how we can see the effect. Yes. I think this is related to the frequency band.
Yes, I agree with you. It must be like this, otherwise we wouldn't see anything. So is there a normal value? Is there any kind of a table for normal values for children's frequency band power? So what kind of power you would be expecting to have from the theta band or from the lower gamma band in this kind of task, or is this all interpreted by the data that you are recording here from your own data?
So about the power, I think there is a mixed result. For example, some studies they show it's like the theta band is like increasing, and then some studies they show it is decreasing, and then the both of them are trying to show that is it related to alertness or something like that. And this actually depends on the task what we are doing, and those minor things are like very precise, and it is also needed to see what we are doing. For example, in our study, during this theta when it was skewed and it was increasing, and when during the target process it was decreasing. So here it shows, for example, and we have this two different condition, and then we compare them double Q versus no Q. So it means that the double Q is showing their increased power when they are giving, and they are it gives alertness to the children, and then we can see that increased power, and then as a result that we can see during the Q period. And then when we are seeing in the target period, so they are using those alertness that making them, and then it is decreasing. So it's like a varying power. It's very hard to tell, okay, at this point this is increasing or this is decreasing. I think still we need lots of work to be done to make sure that whether it's exactly increasing or decreasing, and there are several factors is also involved.
I'm also thinking about the distribution of, I mean, the variation between individuals here, that how typical it is that one child has one of these bands actually with a higher power or lower power than the average. So is there any interpretation for that, like a kind of a baseline level of the different frequency bands?
Yes, I think in our study, that's we would like to use this cluster-based statistic test so that we have like more than 70 children in this. So at least it will show as much as like it's same for the all the children. So that could be one option to see for the larger group. But for example, seeing at the individual level, it's again kind of a challenging task to make it sure.
Yes. What about the children who had attentional problems or reading difficulties? Mm-hmm. You didn't use the time frequency analysis on their data. Are you planning to do so?
Yes, that's the future work we'd like to see, because it's everything is almost the data pipeline and everything is ready. Now we need to change the subject and see, and then do some little bit advanced statistics and then compare them.
So there, of course, as you mentioned, you have more eye movements, you have more blinks, and you mm-hmm. have less participants and maybe also less good epochs. So mm-hmm. it may be a bit harder task than this one, but I wish you the best of luck with that one.
Thank you so much.
I think that it would be very important for us also mm-hmm. to see the results from those data. Okay, so then we can move over to the discussion part, and I think that you have really carefully discussed all the findings that you have presented in your thesis, and we have already discussed many of the findings so far. So maybe I would still ask you I'm now looking at chapter 4.2, the differences in the attentional subprocesses in children with learning problems. So just to summarize how you would interpret those findings, those differences that you see mm-hmm. between the typically developing children and the children who have these attentional or reading problems, and how would you interpret those ERP mm-hmm. findings?
Yes. So at the neuronal source level, we found there are some differences compared to typically developing children, and we found activity like atypical activity, because we don't want to mention something like it is like a deficit or something like that, because we don't have the real comparison whether it is really the effect or it is an advantage or something like that. So that's why we would like to admit as an atypical compared to the control group. So we would like to interpret that this children with attentional problem have different activation compared to the control. So that could be interpreted as like they have some atypical visual processing for the target when they are like acute. And also children with this reading difficulties, they have this left occipital lobe that is different compared to the control children. So that could be related to the secondary deficit area, which I mentioned earlier. So that could be one option. Yes. So, and then there are like other studies which they try to compare this children with reading difficulties and children with attentional problem, and then how this left occipital area very different. So we would like to mention this as in a very broader scale instead of going deeper into it, like saying, okay, this area is like completely different, or this is a deficit in the children, because we don't know the exact value. So it's better to be saying that there is some atypical processing happening, but we don't know. We need to explore what exactly is happening there. And also they showed like one option could be like they showed the larger activity in the attentional problem. So that might be because of the reduced top-down processing or something like that. But still, it's like in a broader way, we could tell that there is a difference, and very precise. We need more work to be done.
Yes. So these children who are 12 years old, and in this setting, they are in the group of reading difficulties. So this means that their reading may be slower than average, or they may be making a little bit more mistakes in their reading than average. These children, maybe some of them have dyslexia, some of them may be diagnosed with dyslexia, some of them maybe not, they are just a little bit slower to read compared to the others. So very often we talk about deficits in the mm-hmm. in the group of these children, and the same goes also for the children with attentional problems. So we talk about their failure to perform in our tests at the level where the others are performing. But if we take a more like holistic look at this situation and we look at people of different ages and people in different situations in their career or maybe in different levels of the society or something like that. So we actually see people performing really, really well. People who have a history of slow reading, attentional problem in their childhood. Maybe some of these problems are very persistent still. They may be able to notice them as an adult. But there is a very strong movement of patient groups and parent groups starting to blame the researchers of calling them children with deficits. They want to turn this discussion around and they want to talk about dyslexia as a feature or even dyslexia as a superpower or attentional problems to be combined with some other features that are very, very beneficial for these children. So what do you think about this kind of movement? And do you think that there is reason for us also to look at these children also in this kind of, through this kind of pink eyeglasses, or how would I describe it, to also see the strength that they have together with these deficiencies?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with that. I think we should also see from different perspective also, because most of the time it is always, as you said, it's seen as something like a deficit or something like that. Majority of the people will see it like this. Then we need to study, but and also we, when the researchers are studying these kind of factors, we have so many limitations. For example, these things are done in a very closed environment. For example, even this experiment, it was done in the closed environment and we recruited the children based on the teacher rating. And they might react, they might do really better during the closed environment and they are not disturbed by anyone. So maybe they can give more focus. Even the ADHD kid, they might can do better because we got the evaluation from the teachers or something like that. So there are these things should be considered. And also we need to do this kind of experiments in a very broader broader way so that we could get more detail about this ADHD and the dyslexic people, because most of the time we are doing in a closed room and giving some specific task, and then we need to see how these are working and compare between the school environment and different environment, and then giving them some trainings or something like that.
Yes. So actually what you are measuring, these differences between the groups of children, you could be measuring things that are related to the deficit, to the problem of allocating attention, to the problem in reading. But at the same time, you could also be measuring something that is actually related to the compensatory mechanisms, which then might be the ones which make these children maybe later, maybe in the time frame of 10 years or 20 years, to excel in their life. So it may be that you have actually found from their brains the key to their future success, even though we are still now interpreting that as a weakness. Isn't that so? Yes. We don't know. We will find out maybe in the future.
It's not here. Yes.
Yes. Okay. You have chapter 4.5 here where you are listing the limitations of the study. We have already discussed many of these, but still I would like you to go through the limitations once more.
So can I discuss about...
Yes, if you can explain them, please.
Yes, yes. So I think the first one when would be like, we use this EEG for doing the source localization, everything. And then we know that it is a poor spatial resolution. And then however, we also use this high density EEG. So that could be a really advantage that could be overtaken. And then the next issue is like we had lack of resources, like individual MRI data. So we used this template MRI data. That was one option. And then the next one is like gender imbalance. which we discussed earlier, like gender imbalance. And then in the method wise, because when we are comparing this atypical group, most of the people will use this linear mixed model to do the statistics. So in our case, we used a repeated measure ANOVA. And then also in the SPSS, they have some internal programs to handle these kind of imbalance, because we didn't have any missing data. All the data were there, like all the trials were there. So we didn't have any missing data. So it will be using this type 3 sum of square methods. Yeah. So that is one step to overcome this limitation. And then in the study 3, we didn't have any comparison to show, because we did only with the children and then studied this time frequency and then showed. And then there are really less number of study using this attention network test to compare between the children. And then so we can use in the future that there are some like adult or the dyslexic, something like that, and then compare it. And then this paradigm, yes. And then this paradigm, as we discussed, it was really a very short time window to do this time frequency analysis. And that was one limitation in the study as well.
Okay, thank you. I think we can now go to the future directions. And in page 52, you have this interesting proposal to perform connectivity analysis.
Yes.
In these groups of children. So how would you actually do that? Would it mean a TMS study or an MRI study, or what kind of study?
Yes, actually that was our initial plan when I started my third paper. We would like to do this time frequency analysis and then later do the brain connectivity analysis, because now we already have the sources. Like we know which source, like a few sources which we already derived. And then using those sources, we can find this directional connectivity. So that was the initial plan. And then when we evolve in the project, okay, we'll need to do it in the future. So using the same study and all the same results, because now we have something concrete, and then using this, we can do the connectivity analysis. So that was the plan which I wrote here.
So that would be based on these EEG data.
Yes,
that makes a lot of sense. And then, of course, it would be interesting also to look at the studies from other teams, looking at the structural studies of children with the attention problems and reading difficulties. And there are already some TMS studies also that are looking at the connective patterns and also the connection times between the different brain regions. But those are performed in adults, so I don't think it's easy to find any child studies with those kinds of methods. So my final question is the use of this information that you have produced. So if you think about the different users of this information, you have the neuroscience community, you have a lot of people who are studying ERPs, a lot of people who are also looking at time frequency spectra, and you have people who are developing the methods studying these event-related potentials, but also different parts of the EEG signal. And then you have these people from the attention field, people who are studying attention. Many of those are neuroscientists, but not all. Some of them are psychologists who are still using just psychological testing for understanding attentional issues, and also, of course, dyslexia and reading-related topics. And then you have the society. And in the society, yes, you have, of course, people who have attentional problems, people who have reading difficulties, their parents. If these people are children, so their parents are very interested, and their family members very interested to help the children in these problems. And then you have the school system, you have the teachers, you have the school psychologists, and all of these large groups of people also ameliorating the problems in reading and attention. So how would you describe your kind of what you have given to these different
each groups? Field. Yes. Okay, thank you so much for the question. Yes, I think, for example, my research work is comprises of various things, like a methodology wise and also cognitive neuroscience wise. So I think whatever the methods which we did in this research work, that will be given to the methods people, like people from the signal processing field, those things, like people who are working with the medical signal processing, like event related potential. So they this part will be advantageous for them. So they know, like, when they are working with this EEG. And then the next part is like people who are working with pure psychology or something like that, then they could get more information from here, like a information for doing this kind of cognitive test. And then like, yeah, taking the children, like children with attentional problem, what kind of difficulties they are facing, and then whether the results could be interpreted for them. And then for the teachers, this could be implemented in the curriculum, like how they can train the kids. For example, when we discuss in the initial time, like in the classroom, like this could be used, for example, when they have like kids from ADHD or dyslexic, so they can develop the curriculum or the classroom like this. So this could be these three different people could utilize from my research work.
Yes. So what would you advise for a teacher to do with a child like this who belongs to these groups? How to change the teaching practically?
Maybe a suggestions, not an advice for them. Yes. Yeah. I think so ADHD kid and the dyslexic kids are not different. I think they need different style of input from the teacher. Yeah, because the typical children, most of the typical children, they develop their skills in the similar pattern at the same time. But these atypical children, they are unique and they need some different inputs compared to the typical groups. So the teachers should focus more on them. It's not like they can't prepare the same curriculum for them. They need different style. For example, giving any inputs or preparing their lectures for them. So they need to think a little bit out of box compared to the typical children when they are giving the lectures.
Yes, and also maybe respect the individual learning style and type of learning and the way of learning of each child. Of course, try to bring them together to learn together with the rest of the children, but in those ways that work best for them. So that's a great challenge for all teachers in the world. So thank you for this discussion, and I'm now ready to give my statement on your thesis. Oh, it was really a great pleasure for me to serve as an opponent of this excellent thesis. We have discussed today this very relevant work. I have found this to be ethically and reliably executed and really well reported. The candidate has been able to ground his research in relevant theory. And of course, this is a challenge in all of these types of studies where we are using experimental methods that are based on psychological theories. It has been clear that the methods of the study are solid, and the candidate has made great progress in the analysis methods. The results are well presented, and they are presented in a coherent manner. It's very easy to follow the results. And the interpretation of the results is clearly based on the actual findings. This work also opens clear needs for future research. It's urgent for us to see the time frequency analysis of the dyslexic and attention problem children, but also there are other avenues that are opened by this thesis. In the discussion, the candidate was able to demonstrate all this knowledge, and he was able to engage himself in a scientific discussion, so it was really a pleasure to discuss with him. For these reasons, I'm going to propose to the Faculty of Education and Psychology that this thesis will be accepted as a doctoral thesis. Congratulations.
Thank you. Honored opponent, I wish to convey my sincere thanks for the valuable comments you have given on my dissertation. If anyone in the audience has any critical comments on my dissertation, please ask the custos for the floor.
Laitostilaisuus on päättynyt. examination as well.